The next case is 05-1993 and 2032, Jeffrey Dana Elston versus Holland Local Schools. In this case, Judge William Wolf of the Second District Court of Appeals will be sitting in place of Justice Resnick, and he will also be sitting on case number 05-1994.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. I am Nick Tomino from the law firm of Tomino and Lachney of Medina, Ohio. I'm here representing the appellant, the Holland Local School District. This case is before the court on both a certified conflict and a discretionary appeal. Both appeals deal with the statutory immunity provided for political subdivisions in Revised Code Chapter 2744. The political subdivision in this case is the Holland Local School District located in Trumbull County. The question presented concerns the applicability of certain immunities and defenses set forth in Revised Code Chapter 2744. The particular question in this case is, under what circumstances can a school district be held liable for the discretionary decisions of its teachers and athletic coaches in the course of their performing their duties in instructing and teaching students and in coaching student athletes? Now, the facts in this case are rather straightforward. At the time of the accident in question, Jeffrey Elston was a member of the Holland freshman baseball team. He was a pitcher on the Holland freshman baseball team. The head coach of the freshman baseball team was Tom Eshman. Now, Mr. Eshman had previously had over 14 years of coaching experience coaching the varsity baseball team for the Holland High School. In the year Mr. Eshman took a break from coaching activity, then returned to coaching in the year 2000 and became the head coach of the Holland freshman baseball team. Now, there is no dispute that as head coach, Mr. Eshman had sole responsibility for the supervision, instruction, training of the members of the Holland freshman baseball team. The accident in question occurred on April 29, 2002. At that time, both the freshman and junior varsity baseball teams were waiting for their respective buses to take them to their respective baseball games that day. While they were waiting, a junior varsity player asked Jeffrey Elston, a member of the freshman baseball team, to come up to the batting cage, which is located on the upper level of the gym, and pitch what was called short toss batting practice to this junior varsity player. Now, Jeffrey had had prior experience with using a device, a protective device called an L-screen that was located in the batting cage. And he understood that the purpose of the L-screen was to protect him from balls being batted back at him. Well, when Jeffrey arrived at the batting cage, he saw that the L-screen was located closer to the plate, the home plate, than usual. It was about 30 feet from home plate. Coach Eshman testified that in doing short toss, they usually had the L-screen anywhere between 30 feet and 45 feet, but when it would be a student pitcher, it would most likely be at 45 feet from the home plate.
The coach did not instruct the students to engage in that play at that time.
That is correct.
They did that on their own.
None of the coaches, either the junior varsity or Mr. Eshman, the freshman baseball coach, knew that this was going on. This was solely decided by the student athletes themselves. After about four or five pitches, one of the batted balls bounced off of the L-screen crossbar and hit Jeffrey Elston in the side of the head. Now, Jeffrey admitted that The reason why he was hit was because he did not get down when he followed through with his pitching motion. And he admitted that because his head was still in the open area, he was exposed to being hit with a batted ball. Suit was brought by Elston and his family against the Holland School District. Well, initially it was brought against both the school district and Coach Eshman. Coach Eshman was later dismissed from the lawsuit. And the lawsuit only alleged negligence against the school district. Motion for summary judgment was filed. The trial court granted it based upon immunity under two sections of the immunity statute, 2744-03A3 and A5. These two sections provide immunity for what you would commonly refer to as discretionary decisions and discretionary judgments by political subdivisions and their employees. On appeal, in a 2-1 decision, the 11th District Court of Appeals reversed the decision, finding that neither section of the immunity statute was applicable. With respect to A3 subsection, that provides that a political subdivision is immune if the act or failure to act is within the discretion of an employee of the political subdivision with respect to policymaking, planning, and enforcement powers by virtue of the duties and responsibilities of that employee's position. Our argument has been all along, and the evidence is, that Coach Eshman, as head coach of the Holland freshman baseball team, had those powers and duties to provide supervision, training, instruction concerning the Holland freshman baseball team. The plaintiffs were arguing that Coach Eshman had failed to act in certain respects, that he had failed to give proper instruction to the students, that he failed to provide certain equipment or arrange to get certain equipment, things like that. All those things are covered by the A3 subsection, meaning that these were all things that were within Coach Eshman's discretion by virtue of the fact that he was head coach of the Holland baseball team. The second section was A5 subsection, which the trial court found provided immunity to the Holland local school district. In that section, a political subdivision is entitled to immunity with respect to discretionary decisions and judgments concerning whether to acquire or how to use materials, supplies, personnel, resources, or other resources, as long as that discretionary judgment is not exercised in a willful or wanton manner. The plaintiffs argued in the Court of Appeals below accepted, in its 2-1 decision, that immunity only applies to actions of the political subdivision itself and not to actions that are connected to the employee.
What would an action of a political subdivision be? The board of the political subdivision making a decision versus, I found that sort of curious observation in the observation in the majority opinion of the Court of Appeals on that point. How else does political subdivision act other than through its employees?
Exactly, Your Honor. That was our argument that with respect to a school district, the only way the school district itself can act is through the school board. Well, a school board is not going to make discretionary decisions regarding how to use resources, equipment, personnel, materials, things like that. It may pass a resolution to purchase some particular item of equipment, but how you're going to use those pieces of equipment or how you're going to use personnel has to be left to the discretionary decision of employees of the school district, particularly when you're talking about teaching and athletic coaches. The school board is not going to tell a baseball coach, this is how you're going to coach your baseball team, this is what instruction you're going to give. This is what equipment you're going to use. No, that's left to the sound discretion of the athletic coach. Similar with teachers teaching in a classroom, physical education teachers teaching in physical education classes. It has to be a decision made by an employee of the political subdivision, so long as it's not, we're not talking about what is referred to in some of the cases as routine or ministerial decisions. What we're talking about are decisions where there is some exercise of judgment about choosing a particular course of action that has some meaning with respect to when you're talking about an athletic coach, the actual coaching of the baseball team.
Well, part of the decision of the 11th Appellate District was that a question of fact existed as to whether the conduct involved was exercised in bad faith or in wanton or reckless manner. But Judge Ford said that wasn't even pled.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The amended complaint was for negligence. It wasn't for violation of A5 under that section.
That's correct,
alleging
Your Honor.
This conduct.
That is absolutely correct, Your Honor.
Yet the Court of Appeals majority opinion determined that was a factual issue for the trial court to resolve.
That's true, Your Honor. And we felt that the Court of Appeals went beyond the arguments that were presented in the trial court and both in the Court of Appeals in that respect. I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal unless there are any questions at the moment from...
I had just a quick one. Discretion involved in this case was what, the policy of whether or not to require the players to wear helmets?
That would be one of the discretionary decisions, Your Honor. There were really two aspects of the plaintiff's claim. One concerned the instruction of the student athletes in general about how to use the L screen. The other would be discretionary decisions regarding equipment, in this case, the use of helmets while pitching short toss. Both of those, we feel, go beyond routine or ministerial decisions. These are decisions that actually impact the whole purpose of having a baseball team, a school athletic baseball team, is to instruct students on playing baseball and the use of equipment.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomito. Mr. Kish.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please the court, my name is Brian Kish. I have the privilege of representing young Jeffrey Elston, the appellee in this matter. Justice Wolf, if I could begin by referring to one of your comments regarding what discretion, if any, was used, and specifically what discretion is it that is at issue from Coach Eshman. It's our position that the first thing that you need in order to trigger the defense or the immunity in 2744.03A3 is you need a decision. And that decision then has to constitute discretion with regard to policymaking, planning, or enforcement powers that person has by virtue of their duties. Coach Eshman never made a decision in this case. There was never an affirmative act on his behalf with regard to requiring or not requiring these students to have helmets. It's best illustrated in the supplement between pages 69 and 71 when during his deposition. Now, this incident is 2002, suits filed 2003, finally deposed sometime in 2004. And only then does it first occur to him that helmets might have been a useful thing for the students.
But didn't he testify at one point that he thought that it just wasn't, it never occurred to him that it was necessary?
That is correct, Your Honor. And then as we sort of talk through what his level of authority was, as being the freshman baseball coach, the question I asked him was, well, if you decided to go out and buy new helmets, did you have that authority and discretion? No. He said he would have had to go through the athletic department. And then he said, well, pitchers and hitters can't wear the same helmets. And then I explained to him, well, isn't it true that a pitcher from just 30 feet could wear an existing batting helmet that's not being currently used by a hitter? And the three words that he said were like the clouds parting and the sun opening up on him finally. Oh, yeah, probably. That's 2.5 years after this incident occurred. There was never a thoughtful weighing of options that he entertained or that he conducted prior to the time of this incident happening. And Justice Moore, you're absolutely correct that the coach was not present when this occurred. But if he had been standing right next to that batting cage net, this incident would have occurred exactly the same way. And I say that because there was no instruction on how to throw from behind the health screen at 30 feet. Instruction was given at 60 feet. But those instructions are different at 30 feet. And the reason why they're different, I understand that not everyone has a baseball background, but if you could indulge me just briefly. If a pitcher is using his normal throwing motion from 60 feet, throwing, let's say, a fastball, and he's right-handed, much like I am, the opening of the L screen is going to be on his right side. The force of the pitch is going to force his momentum from the top right, and then as he follows through, down and left. He's going to be behind the screen. Coach Eshman testified that this short toss drill from 30 feet, from 40 feet, it's a hitting exercise. The hitter swinging just as hard. His goal of making contact is just as straightforward.
Counsel, can you explain to me how the Court of Appeals got from an amended complaint on negligence to remanding on issues of willful wanton when it was not pled?
In short, Your Honor, I believe that the Court of Appeals referred to notice pleading and allowed the evidence of negligence to come in. What I can tell you is that...
But notice pleading was not... I mean, notice pleading requires words, and you never used willful wanton words in the amended complaint, so notice pleading doesn't apply here. They made a... They stated a claim and remanded on a stated claim that you never pled. How did that happen, and where does the case go? Do you consider yourself allowed now to present willful wanton negligence on a remand if we affirm this?
If affirmed by this court, it's exactly my position that I am not held to a burden of willful or wanton. If this court affirms what the 11th District did, that A3 does not apply because the coach didn't exercise any discretion, and that A5 doesn't apply because it only applies to school districts and not to what the employees do, then this case never gets past the second tier of the analysis, the exception to non-liability found in 2744.02b4, which speaks only of negligence.
So you, despite the language of the Court of Appeals, you agree you did not assert willful wanton, and you don't need, in your opinion, to prove that under the current status of the case?
The current status of the case, yes. I'm also aware that was an issue that appellant requested that this court accept a jurisdiction over. This court has declined, but I would agree with Your Honor.
I was keenly interested in your description of the pitching here. Could you finish your your description of it?
Sure. When you're throwing from 30 feet, Your Honor, the emphasis of this particular hitting drill, as testified by Coach Eshman, is on the hitter, about increasing the quality number of strikes that the hitter swings or that the hitter gets to see, and the quickness with which this drill can be done. Therefore, the pitcher is not using his normal pitching mechanics. He's not doing a windup. He's not throwing the ball as forcefully as he can. Both my client and Coach Eshman clearly said the pitcher's simply lobbing the ball, and you lob the ball by going like this. There's no shoulder movement. There's no rotation of the hips. There's none of the normal body mechanics of pitching a baseball that from 60 feet naturally and normally take you behind the net. Those are completely absent at 30 feet, and that's why the instruction was so needed in this case.
Why does it make a difference here in terms of the accident that occurred, the injury?
It makes a difference because what the coach failed to do, and it failed to even occur to him to do it, was that he failed to instruct these young players how to pitch from behind an L screen at 30 or 45 feet. And if he was going to conduct a drill in which he allowed these players to do that, now, true, the coach wasn't there on this day, but acknowledges that the players had pitched at that distance from times before. Even with proper instruction, even with a proper demonstration, those young men needed to be wearing a helmet just due to the severe reduction
okay,
in
but that's a
the reaction
yeah,
time.
Yeah, but you switched now to helmet from how the pitching was. You said that
okay.
the 30-foot distance was significant here, and that the plaintiff, I guess other students, had never been instructed on how to pitch from that?
They had been instructed when pitching from 60 feet.
Okay, right. Never been instructed on how to pitch from 30 feet.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in all complete candor, my student was one of the pitchers that did receive that instruction from 60 feet.
Well, counsel, if the instruction from 60 feet was to follow through so you're behind the screen, is that fair?
Yes.
Well, obviously you're behind the screen to protect yourself.
Yes.
Correct?
That is correct.
So they were instructed to make sure you're behind the screen when the batter connects to the ball. Correct?
Yes.
Well, that instruction applies whether you're at 60 feet, 50 feet, or 30 feet. Make sure you're behind the screen.
To learned people like ourselves and to adults, yes, Your Honor. But to a 15-year-old freshman and a group of freshman kids that have never seen an L screen before.
This was this child's first encounter with an L screen?
He had pitched from a distance of 60 feet on 4 or 5 occasions.
Using the same L screen?
Yes. Never before had thrown at the reduced distance of 30 feet. He did not have the ability to appreciate the risks that you and I see. And I think that's why, if this case ultimately ends up in front of a jury, that he's entitled to an instruction to evaluate his conduct based upon his age, his experience, and things of that nature.
And putting that aside, you said, and the crux of your statement here is that the coach never made a decision and therefore never exercised discretion. And if the coach made the decision, forget about the helmet decision, if the coach made the decision to instruct on how to protect yourself by use of this device, this L screen, is that not a decision?
I apologize, I'm not following the court. If the judge made the decision on how to protect...
No, not the judge, the coach. I'm sorry, did I say judge?
No, I think I did.
Okay. I'm saying coach. The coach is the one that has to make the decision here, and your argument is he never made a decision, so he can't cloak himself in the immunity that attaches to discretionary activity.
He made a decision and gave an instruction when at 60 feet. Never occurred to him to repeat the instruction, give different instructions, or conduct the drill in a different manner from 30 feet because of the heightened risk of injury that it presented. It never occurred to him. It was never a series of options that he weighed.
Didn't the student say to the coach that he knew he should have ducked, gotten behind the screen after he pitched? I thought there was...
In his deposition, Your Honor, a couple years after the fact, when the young man is sitting in a deposition with 4 titanium screws and a plate in his head...
He's much wiser now. After he's,
yeah, well, now when he's, asked, yeah. Hey, if you ducked, would you have gotten hit? Of course he's going to say no. But even with that, he's looking back with the hindsight of an 18-year-old.
Well, you just accused the coach of doing the same thing. Why is the coach guilty if he looks back with hindsight, but the student not?
Your Honor, respectfully, we can never charge freshmen, 15-year-old, even seniors at 18-year-olds, with having the same knowledge of risks and potential causes of injury that we can to their coaches. Their coaches are the ones that are supposed to know better, that are supposed to recognize the risks and give the instruction to the students.
Mr. Kish, this was a ricochet injury?
Yes, Your Honor, it was.
So that the pitching differences between the 60 feet and the toss at 30 feet really didn't have a play into how the injury occurred?
I would disagree, Your Honor, because a lot of the difference in the distance has to do with the reaction time.
But the ball didn't come directly to the one who had thrown it. The ball apparently bounced.
It bounced off of the net directly in front of my client, though. It didn't ricochet off of a sidewall or something else. And I'm not sure that you and I are on the same page there, but had the same hit in the same area been achieved from 60 feet, at least now my client has a chance to get a glove up and protect himself, or additional 1 to 1.5 seconds to step to his left, to duck down. But at 30 feet, with the reduced reaction time, he simply never had that opportunity.
Would you address the legal issue of the fact, the holding that individual employees aren't the ones provided immunity, that it has to be some other entity that makes the decision to have that apply? Can you give me an example of what that would be?
With regard to the A5 section, Your Honor?
Yes.
Yes, I can. Political subdivisions are defined and identified by statute. They included municipal corporations, townships, hospital commissions, the Board of Hospital Commissioners, Board of Hospital Trustees, Regional Planning Commission, County Planning Commission, Joint Planning Councils, Port Authorities, Solid Waste Management Districts. Each of these entities act by and through resolutions. And it's absolutely not unworkable for that particular provision, the A5, since it references only the political subdivision and not the employees, to protect only the actions taken by that entity as a group.
So in your opinion, no individual in any school system can make a decision that is protected? It can only come through a board resolution and to be protected?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That is not my opinion. And I believe one of the amicus briefs contended that if the court were to rule as I ask it to, that employees, teachers, and coaches lose all forms of discretion.
Well, then give me an example of a decision that they could make individually that would be protected.
A decision that involves discretion, a thoughtful decision. There are billions of them.
That's contrary to your stated proposition that only boards can make these decisions. If an individual teacher makes a thoughtful decision that involves discretion, you agree that the individual is still protected?
Forgive me, Your Honor. The example I gave was in reference to the A3 section and not the A5. So going back to the A5, your question to me, as I understand it, is when can an employee in that situation engage in a discretionary act?
Right. When can an individual make a decision that is protected by A3 or A5?
Well, I think that there's a big distinction, because I don't think that they can under A5, but they'll always be guided and protected by the protections afforded to them by A3, which simply requires that they utilize discretion, as well as A6, which gives them personal immunity for anything as long as it's not reckless.
So if this coach had actually employed thoughtful discretion, he would have been entitled to immunity under A3.
I would agree with you.
So then don't we come down to a factual decision of whether he employed discretion?
I think that's both a factual and a legal determination, but yes, Your Honor. If there are no other questions, I thank the court for its time and ask the court to affirm the decision of the 11th District in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Kish. Mr. Tomino, you've saved a little more than 3 minutes of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, with respect to the immunity under A3, the statute doesn't require that a decision, a discretionary decision, has to be made. What it says is that the act or failure to act that allegedly causes the injury has to be within the discretion of the employee by virtue of his position. What that means is that in this case, the allegation is that Coach Eshman failed to take certain steps. He failed to give proper instruction to the students. The argument by plaintiff is that, well, he did not make a conscious decision to instruct poorly. This is a failure to act that is within his discretion. Teaching, instructing the members of the Holland freshman baseball team was within Coach Eshman's discretion. As long as it's within his discretion, whether or not he actually made a conscious decision doesn't matter under A3. What matters is it within his discretion by virtue of his duties as the head coach of the freshman baseball team? So,
And the only thing that would take it out of that would be if he said, I'm not going to instruct because I hope these kids get hurt.
Well, that, yes, Your Honor,
then
but that
would... Then that takes it out...
That would be outside of his duties as, I would say, as the head coach. Under A5, there is a caveat for willful and wanton misconduct. But again, it can't be just a resolution of the school board or the resolution of the city council, because you're talking about not just acquiring equipment, you're talking about how to use equipment, how to use personnel. And those boards do not make those decisions for the political subdivision. It's the individual employees that make those discretionary decisions. And that's why, in order to give meaning to the statute, it has to apply to both.
Counsel.
Yes.
I have a totally different take on A3. And that is, if you look through the whole act, some things are in, some things are out. A3, I believe, was intended to exempt decisions of the Zoning Board of Appeals, the policy. It talks about, with respect to policy making, planning, or enforcement powers. The legislature, when they adopted this, did not want to open up the possibility of litigation over judgmental decisions of a policymaking nature. And that's what A3 is about, nothing more.
Well, Your Honor, it would apply under those circumstances, but it also, in the school context, would and should apply to decisions made by the teacher in the classroom. The teacher on a day-to-day basis is going to make decisions regarding instruction of his or her students.
If that's the application, then everything becomes exempt. I mean, you might as well just say schools aren't liable for anything that happens on their premises, unless it's a slip and fall kind of case or something like that, that is a premises liability. That's not what the statute says.
Your Honor, there are cases, and rightfully so, that find that what are called routine or ministerial decisions, where there isn't really any judgment making involved, can incur liability for a school district. For example, supervision of students in a parking lot that are being picked up by their parents. There's one case on that subject. So, but when you're talking about actual instruction by the educator, by the teacher, by the athletic coach, you have to provide them with that discretion. Otherwise, you're going to have lawsuits over, I think Coach Eshman should have instructed the freshman baseball team this way as opposed to this way. It would never end. You could have a suit anytime you had any injury in a school athletic or in a classroom. If there are, I see my time's up. If the panel doesn't have any questions, I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tomino. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.